This episode is brought to you by Progressive. Most of you aren't just listening right now. You're driving, cleaning, and even exercising. But what if you could be saving money by switching to Progressive? Drivers who save by switching save nearly $750 on average, and auto customers qualify for an average of 7 discounts. Multitask right now. Quote today at progressive.com. Progressive Casualty Insurance Company and Affiliates. National average 12-month savings of $744 by new customers surveyed who saved with Progressive between June 2022 and May 2023. Potential savings will vary. Discounts not available in all states and situations.
The New Yorker Radio Hour is supported by the Sympathizer podcast from HBO. From executive producers Park Chan-wook and Robert Downey Jr., The Sympathizer is the new HBO original limited series based on the Pulitzer Prize-winning novel of the same name. On The Sympathizer podcast, join host Philip Nguyen in conversation with the cast, crew, and author Viet Thanh Nguyen as they discuss the making of this historic series. Stream new episodes of HBO's The Sympathizer, Sundays exclusively on Max, and listen to The Sympathizer podcast wherever you listen to podcasts.
Listener supported, WNYC Studios.
Now, the real-life Trump presidency is all of 3 weeks old, and U.S. foreign policy seems to shift on an almost hourly basis from tweet to tweet, from eruption to eruption. One day, the president is having tough conversations with longtime allies like Australia, and the next day, he's backtracking on his own blustering rewrite of our official position on Israel and the settlements. Robin Wright has reported on foreign affairs for decades for The New Yorker and many other publications. She recently sat down with Ryan Crocker, a longtime diplomat who served in some very troubled and unstable countries, and with John McLaughlin, the deputy director of the CIA under two presidents.
Welcome to the show. I'm so delighted to talk to two men whose lives have intersected with mine now since at least the 1970s. Both of you have served eight presidents, one as one of America's finest diplomats and the other as one of the highest ranking intelligence officers. President Trump's doctrine appears to be based on America first. In the 21st century, in an era of globalization, is it possible to actually craft a foreign policy that is America first to the exclusion of others? What are the consequences of an America first?
Well, America first, interpreted literally, just won't work. I mean, America first, if you mean think about what our interests are and advance them, sure. But America first, interpreted literally, won't work because every problem we have is one that crosses national boundaries, problems, whether it's terrorism, proliferation of weapons, concerns about cyber, everything is a problem for many nations, and they have to pull together policies that help everyone. So the whole idea of America first cuts against all of the trends that we are now seeing evident in the world.
Ryan, when you look at the Trump administration's foreign policy and what's transpired so far, do you have a sense that the chaos that comes across is intentional? Is this lack of experience?
Well, I don't think anyone could deliberately produce chaos on this scale as a matter of policy. So I do think it reflects inexperience. I also think that it reflects the president's view that he needs to fulfill the promises he made in the campaign, that as you look at these various steps. I would hope, as the extraordinary weight of that office settles in on him, he will take a broader view of those in government careers who are there to help him. Look, the president really needs the Foreign Service. We're a pretty small organization, but we're everywhere in the world. An ounce of diplomacy up front may save an administration from having to deploy a 100,000-ton aircraft carrier for military solutions when diplomatic ones were possible. So I think they need to take a deep breath over there, sit under a tree for a while, contemplate the verities, and consider how they actually run a government, because they're not running a government right now.
John, President Trump appears to have picked his first foreign policy fight with Iran. The National Security Advisor came out rather dramatically at a press briefing and said the Trump administration was putting Iran on notice. And the Treasury Department has slapped new sanctions on Iran for its ballistic missile test. And I'm interested in your reflections on how dangerous this is. President Trump tweeted, Iran is playing with fire. They don't appreciate how kind President Obama was to them, not me. And so what do you think the intentions are? What's your sense of how policy might change? How confrontational is this administration getting with the Islamic Republic?
Well, you know, we can all have complaints about Iran on various levels, so let's not pretend that they're doing everything we like. But here's the point. The administration has to be careful here for a number of reasons. First, having drawn this line of sorts, let's call it that, if you're put on notice, you are drawing a line of sorts, I would bet anything that Iran will now launch other missiles. That's what they will do. It's virtually certain they will do it again. So does the administration know what they will do then? And if they're intending, and if they don't, then they've just drawn a line that will ultimately come to haunt them. And if they do wish to get into a fight with Iran, one thing I've learned in my government career is when you inflict violence, you don't know where it's going. Even if it's justified, you don't know where it's going. So you have to be prepared for that. You have to be prepared for retaliation, because Iran, if it's in a fight, is not going to sit there. It's going to do something, either through proxies or directly, and their proxy, Hezbollah, is quite capable. And the final thing is, some weeks ago, I wrote an article, said, can we handle the truth about ISIS? And one of the truths I put on the table, awkwardly, is that, you know, one of the few other countries fighting ISIS is Iran. So it's a complicated world. It does not yield well to tweets. And I think they need to be a little careful and just think it through. It's not to say that Iran is our pal, but think it through before we get in a fight.
Ryan, your very first posting was in Iran in the 1970s. And you were the one who actually started the first dialogue with Iran when you were ambassador in Baghdad. This was a tentative dialogue that ultimately led to, sporadically, erratically, a kind of discussion and 2 years of torturous diplomacy that produced the nuclear deal. What is the danger that the process that you helped launch begins to unravel?
Well, that follows right on to what John said. The world is a very complicated, messy place, and no part of it is more complicated than Iran. And there is no country in the Middle East we know less about than Iran, because we haven't been on the ground there since 1979. I started the conversation with the Iranians right after 9/11 in Geneva.
Over Afghanistan.
Over Afghanistan. And we were getting some stuff done, including turnover of some al-Qaeda operatives. And then we had State of the Union 2002, Axis of Evil. That pretty well finished the dialogue.
The president has openly advocated for taking Iraq's oil. He said that at the CIA. He's said that torture works. He's advocated what some people think are war crimes. How alarmed are you by this rhetoric? John?
I think he's not aware of what he's saying yet. I think this is just stuff that's popping out because he speaks extemporaneously, and he's still caught to some degree in campaign mode. So I'm not particularly alarmed. When I think about a statement like let's take Iraq's oil, I've always thought that that is beyond stupid. In other words, I don't even know what it means. try and operationalize that? Does that mean sending troops to surround oil wells while you pump it out and then transport it out of the country? Or does it mean something else? I have no idea what he's talking about. So I assume it won't happen. So I'm not worried about it.
Ryan, there was a dissent communication by something over 1,000 diplomats. Put this in context. Was this a big deal? Was this unusual? And what impact do you think it might have?
Well, Robin, it's a huge deal. And normally the way it works is you file your dissent, it is completely ignored, and then 6 months later you will be given an award for dissent. So it's an institution. It's part of the fabric of the Foreign Service and the State Department, but never have we seen anything on this scale. I guess the highest we may have gone on signatures before, maybe 50, 60. This is over 1,000.
And what does that reflect about sentiment in the State Department right now, about the Trump administration?
Well, clearly a lot of angst there. Secretary Tillerson will need to grapple with that. I frankly think he was a good choice. There were a few good choices for that cabinet. I'm delighted that Jim Mattis is our Secretary of Defense, and John Kelly for Homeland Security.
These are all good people.
They are great people. I know them all.
What would you say to young foreign or old foreign policy officers when they have to make this decision? They dissent from policy. Should they quit, or should they continue to serve, hoping that they can help craft policy in a different direction?
There is always the option to resign on a matter of principle. It is very seldom done in any of the services, not in the Foreign Service, not in our military, not in the CIA. So my advice would be, look, this may be the time your country needs you the most to provide your analysis, your recommendations, steps forward based on your experience and judgment. In the Foreign Service, the government spends a lot of money to give you the language skills and all of the other training that you need to be a professional diplomat. So the bar would have to be pretty darn high, I think, before I would support anyone taking the step of resignation.
Prediction is the low form of journalism, but every president eventually confronts a foreign policy crisis. Where and when do you see that first crisis happening?
There's so much to watch. I think if you were trying to think of the things that will come and hit the administration in the face early, it's a long list, and probably something that I won't think of is on it. Typically, at the beginning of an administration, the thing that surprises you and shocks you and creates the first crisis is something you haven't thought of. For example, in the Bush administration in 2001, when a hotshot Chinese pilot nipped one of our planes in the Pacific and sent it down on Hainan Island, we had about a month of crisis with China over what happens to that plane. No one anticipated that. A fruit seller ignites himself in Tunisia, and you have the Arab Spring. People knew there were pressures building in the Middle East, but no one anticipated that that would be the spark. So right now, I'd say watch North Korea. I've been watching North Korea's missile program since the mid-90s. I am pretty confident that within the term of this president, North Korea will acquire the ability to send an ICBM across the Pacific to us with a nuclear weapon on it. And we will probably detect that development in advance, and the question will arise, what are you going to do about that?
Ryan, what are you watching most closely now?
Again, my entire experience has been in the Middle East, so I am sure my favorite region in the world will distinguish itself by once again producing a White House-level crisis, you know, whether it will be with Iran, whether it'll be in Syria, whether it will be someplace none of us have thought of yet. We are looking at a critical moment in world history. The international order established after World War II persisted for 60-odd years. That order was designed and led by the U.S. I think we're at a moment now when the U.S. isn't really sure it wants to lead anymore. And frankly, that didn't start with Trump. That started with President Obama. When he referred to our NATO allies as free riders, that's a term that President Trump would be very comfortable with. I would simply caution, with a world order now over seven decades that has prevented a major war in Europe, before you throw it over the side, you'd better have a plan for the coming order. If we think the chaos in the White House has been significant, we'll see it on a global scale if we and our allies do not work together either to endorse an order that has stood us well or to fashion a new one before we walk away from it.
You know, we talk about global order. It's not an abstract concept. Global order is very concrete. It consists of allies we've made, alliances we've made, coalitions we've built. It consists of rules that we all follow. One of the rules is that borders are inviolable. And yet Putin has broken at least three different treaties in invading Ukraine. Are we going to accept that? We could, but if we did, it would have consequences for global order. You would have thrown away that rule. So here's the problem. No one else aspires to lead the world, really. They aspire to follow their own interests and secure them. And even though U.S. leadership is often criticized, it's hard for me to imagine a better circumstance, because the United States, for all of its flaws and all of its mistakes, still leads with the interests of others in mind as well as its own interests, and leads in a way that advances values, not just narrow interests. And I think that would be a terrible thing to lose. And the world would... That's the story of the 20th century. That is the story of the 20th century. That's why the 20th century was the low point in human violence, and the Second World War, the largest single event in human history. So that's what global order loss looks like.
Ryan, if you had one piece of advice to give the Trump administration, what would it be?
Engage.
With whom?
I, for some years, have been the dean of the Bush School of Government and Public Service at Texas A&M. That is Bush 41. Take a page from President Bush's notebook. Start to build relations. As soon as he got to the Oval Office, he was making calls, not because there was a crisis to solve, but just to build relationships. That paid off for us in the first Gulf War, where Syria and Egypt each sent a division to be part of the action there. This only happens if you've got a president who is engaged. Sadly, President Obama, who's a remarkable individual at every level, wasn't very good at engagement or wasn't very interested. So I hope President Trump and Secretary Tillerson in particular, Secretary Mattis is already out doing diplomacy and with our East Asian allies, that they understand that to make America work, you got to make the world work. And that doesn't come from just tweeting at the world. You've got to build relations. And I hope very much the president and his key aides take that step.
John?
I would say, think about the difference between tough and tough-minded. You know, everyone in Washington likes to beat their chest and show how tough they are. Tough-minded is harder. Tough-minded is hard government. Tough-minded means put your heads together, think hard about the secondary and tertiary consequences of what you're thinking about doing. That's a lot harder than acting tough.
John McLaughlin was deputy director of the CIA under Presidents Clinton and George W. Bush. Ryan Crocker has served as the ambassador to Afghanistan, Iraq, Pakistan, Syria, Kuwait, and Lebanon. And they spoke with The New Yorker's Robin Wright.
On Notes from America, we have conversations with people across the country about how we can truly become the nation that we claim to be. Each week, we talk about race, our politics, education, relationships, usually all of them, because everything's connected. And you, our listeners, are at the center of those conversations. I'm Kai Wright. Join me on Notes from America, wherever you get your podcasts.